Pete was truly surprised when I was asked to speak about anything involving compassion because, as you've heard, it's not necessarily my strong suit. But I'm here today and I'm thrilled you've decided to spend some of your Sunday with me. I should tell you that speaking here has made my very religious father, who's here, and my husband, who's the son of a United Church minister, extremely thrilled. Because this is the closest I've ever gotten to a pulpit. Thank you. Yeah, I'm not that. I'm also 6 years older than my brother. Yeah, is that okay? Good. Thank you very much. This speaker series is anomalous. I think the very idea of compassionate justice is anomalous. These days, compassion is just not an adjective that is used to describe justice in the public dialogue. One is viewed as a little weak, a bleeding heart, or worse still, insensitive when criminal justice reform is mentioned. Compassion in justice is not even aspirational anymore in our society. That is the reality of today. And we need to ask ourselves why it is that criminal justice reform is stepped around so gingerly in the very place where it must be discussed, openly and vigorously advocated. Why must any criminal justice reform, the mere thought of it, be excused or couched or hidden in a piece of legislation? What exactly is it that politicians... You can't hear me up there? Oh, dear. Is it okay now? How does that? Yes? Okay. So why must any criminal justice form be excused? What exactly is it that politicians are so afraid of? Well, injecting compassion in any dialogue about the criminal justice system, whether it be in the context of bail or trial or sentencing or prison rights, is met with instinctive resistance. This is the stuff of groups like this that talk about compassion and justice in the same breath, a dedicated few. But it has long since been removed from any recent dialogue about criminal justice that I can see. In the mainstream, it is a dirty word, something to be tiptoed around. As I said, a reform might slip in here or there when we're not looking, but nothing substantial, nothing that would require any explanation to the public. It does not matter what aspect of criminal justice you think about, reform simply has not been in the cards for decades. And the reason is clear. Compassionate justice, when you talk about bail, means that too many people are being released on bail when they should be incarcerated even before being convicted. Compassionate justice in trials can only mean that you give all the rights to the accused. Compassionate justice in sentencing can only mean leniency to prisoners, and that means sentences aren't tough enough, and our communal desire for punishment and retribution is unsatisfied. It is thought that we are better, safer, more equitable if we accept this less compassionate concept of justice. And so the idea of compassion has quietly been excised from any dialogue about criminal justice and replaced by neutral and neutered terms that insulate against the most damning charge of all to any public figure, being soft on crime. Now, this is a successful strategy because of the way we've come to think about criminal justice. Compassion in the criminal justice system is pitched as an either-or proposition. If compassion is shown to the accused, the pitch goes, then it necessarily means it cannot be shown to victims. This is a false narrative. Don't you buy one word of it, this either-or proposition. It is an artificial bifurcation of the complexity of issues that need to be balanced in the criminal justice system. It's an artificial bifurcation of our humanity. Compassion must be extended to all participants in the justice system because it is a harrowing process to go through, whether you're sitting in the witness box or you're sitting in the dock. Showing compassion to all participants means acknowledging our humanity, and with that, our failings, our ability to change, our sometimes inexplicable conduct. All of it acknowledges our humanity, and criminal justice, at the end of the day, is in the business of dealing with humans, often in their worst moments, often at their most vulnerable. But the criminal justice system is not capable of operating in black and white, in either's ors. It is, by its nature, full of grays that we embody as human beings. So the either you're for us or against us dichotomy ignores that the criminal justice system is required to take into account those complexity of issues, often at odds with each other, and to try to reconcile them in some rational way. For example, we often exclude evidence in court, even if it's reliable. And we do so because we say it's unfairly obtained. At the same time, we know that the justice system must come to factual findings to resolve issues. So obviously, initially, accuracy in adjudication and fairness would appear to be at odds. Yet, we in this society reconcile them. And that essential reconciliation that we go through in the criminal justice system requires a consideration of all of the factors and a delicate balancing of what we are about in this society and what we are trying to achieve. And in that balancing, either or propositions simply do not work. Now, this lack of compassion that's become endemic in this society and in this conversation is facilitated by myths that are peddled. One of the most insidious of these myths is that the person who's accused holds all the cards. This is a distortion. And of course, it ignores our Anglo-American history, which is very important. It used to be that all criminal acts historically were treated as private disputes between two parties. It became a contest of who was more worthy of belief, more resourced. And in those days, people who were called compurgators, oath helpers, would come to court and attest to which of the two parties in the criminal dispute were more worthy of belief. The mischief of that system was that it favored the wealthy and the powerful. And gradually, the idea that criminal justice was really a private dispute between two people was replaced with the belief that the investigation, prosecution, and punishment of crime was not a private issue, but rather a matter that was a societal concern. And while the shift in thinking solved many problems by equalizing a little bit, leveling the playing field amongst members of the public, that shift also created other problems. Because the state is a powerful adversary to have. That is the party who truly holds all the cards. And state abuse from the Star Chamber on resulted in the need to protect individuals from abuse of state power. And so came the recognition of rights in the conduct of an investigation or a trial. We did not historically give rights to the accused because we were soft-hearted, but rather because state abuses in the investigation and prosecution of crime, usually visited upon the most marginalized in the community, required these parameters to ensure fair play. None of that history gives the accused all the rights. And I can tell you, having spent 26 years as a criminal lawyer, I have never walked into a courtroom thinking, wow, isn't it amazing that my client has all of these constitutional rights and the state has nothing? Nor has a client ever sat in my office and said, isn't it awesome that I've lost my job, my savings, my family, and potentially my liberty, because golly gee, I now get to take advantage of all these wonderful constitutional rights. When people complain that the accused has all the rights, it's worth remembering that we actually all of us, have them and exercise them daily. And while rights are most often litigated in the context of criminal cases, where our democratic commitment is often tested the most, in tough cases, the thing we must remember is that every day, each and every single day, we, the members of society, are the beneficiaries of those rights. Accused people don't have all the rights. We all have all the rights. The police do not harass you and knock down your door because there is a constitutional right that protects each and every one of you. Just as the police cannot pick you up, throw you in jail, beat you, and question you. Because you, too, have all the rights. The truth is, though, that those rights are only tested where the state knocks down a door and finds something, or beats someone and actually gets a confession. It's in the criminal context that these rights and their parameters are litigated. But don't you forget that we law-abiding citizens have those rights too. That's why you're not being beaten or searched by the police. It's just that our daily exercise of our rights rarely lands on the front page. There is no system of justice that has been invented that has been able to give rights to law-abiding citizens and none to those accused of crime. Constitutional rights are not accorded because you are deserving. They are accorded because they represent our foundational democratic values. They are accorded because they are what we are. But the distinction between the law abiders and others does work for somebody. The us and them dichotomy that is often resorted to works to the advantage of those in power and those seeking power. People caught up in the criminal justice system, the racialized, the marginalized, the poor, the mentally ill, well, those are easy targets to pick off. Think about it. Think about the phrases we always hear, soft on crime, tough on crime, both utterly meaningless slogans that get trotted out. Soft on crime is nothing more than an accusation of moral failure. And the latter, being tough on crime, is trotted out as though it's a badge of honor. But these slogans do one thing. They achieve one very important goal. You are either on one side or the other. You are either with us or against us. And that is why politicians invent imaginary wars to wage in the criminal justice system. Think of how many wars have been declared. There have been declarations of a war on drugs, a war on terrorism, a war on gun violence. We are, it seems, in the criminal justice system, in a perpetual state of battle. But remember this one thing. Every war requires an enemy. So before a war is ever waged and declared by politicians, an enemy is created. That is what is really happening in these declarations of war. A target has been identified, and a war is manufactured. And that is done by creating the us and them. You know, one of the most famous wars is the war on drugs. And it was actually Nixon's declaration of a war on drugs that preceded Reagan's war on drugs, a mantle that he famously picked up. At a press conference in 1971, Nixon identified drug abuse as, quote, public enemy number one in the United States. He may have thought to identify himself. When somebody was subsequently asked to explain, why did you declare the war on drugs? Why was that the thing that Nixon picked? Here's what they said, and this is a quote. The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. And who was that said it? John Ehrlichman, counsel and assistant to President Nixon, and his Watergate co-conspirator. The incarceration rate when the war on drugs was declared in the United States doubled and then tripled the incarceration of racialized communities. And if you take the time to go back even further in history, you will see that the criminalization of drugs throughout American history was and continues to be linked to race. This is an old playbook. So what's the urgency now, you say? What's changed? Well, I believe that we are at a critical juncture in society where our moral fiber, the things we hold dear and the things that we've taken for granted are being tested. Our commitment to democracy, which we have to remember is a fairly young social construct, is inextricably linked to a fair justice system. There's no question that the democratic political experiment has taken quite a beating in recent years. And I believe that we need to critically think about the role of the justice system in society in protecting us from power-hungry autocrats. What this requires is pushing the public, and most importantly, lawmakers, to think about the justice system as a whole, not just in the context of a specific case or a specific type of offense. Now, I have to confess, because I know I'm among friends, that for the last few years, I feel a bit like Chicken Little, convinced that the sky is falling if we do not all collectively raise our hands up in the air together and hold it up. There is an urgency to the intersection between the justice system and political discourse right now. Blame Trump and Ford and the likes of Orban on Hungary or Erdogan, but mostly Trump. For me, it started this way a while back when the travel ban was passed and a judge had the audacity to stay its force. And so the minute that came to pass, President Trump was extremely annoyed, and he did what any good policymaker would do. He took to Twitter. And so he started tweeting out quite rapidly the following. The opinion of this so-called judge, which essentially takes law enforcement away from our country, is ridiculous and will be overturned. I thought, okay, so-called is sort of insulting, but I can stomach that. Then he continued, because the ban was lifted by a judge, many very bad and dangerous people may be pouring into our country. A terrible decision. Then he upped the ante again. What is our country becoming when a judge can halt a Homeland Security travel ban and anyone, even with bad intentions, can come to the United States? The courts are making the job very difficult. And then he continued, just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system. People pouring in, bad! Exclamation mark. The judge opens up our country to potential terrorists and others that do not have our best interests at heart. Bad people are very happy. So let's deconstruct a little bit what happened here and why it mattered beyond entertainment or horror. When a tweet asks, what's the country coming to when a judge can overrule the government, that is an attack on the very constitutional core of a democracy, the inherent and independent checks and balances that are foundational principles. It is the role of courts to ensure that the governments act consistent with the Constitution and the laws of the country. It's the very heart of a democracy that the rights of individuals are not taken away by popular vote, that the minority or the unpopular are protected against the majority rule. And so when the leader of a democratic country says the judge put the country in peril, what is really being said is that if something happens, the court system, the justice system, is responsible. And that is because they don't have the best interests of citizens at heart, that they dare second-guess the executive. Now, this was not new behavior for him because back in a rally in 2016, Judge Curiel of the United States District Court was called a hater by Donald Trump. And he was the judge that was actually sitting in the Trump University lawsuit. And Trump said this, I have a judge who is a hater of Donald Trump, who is hostile appointed by Barack Obama, and Mexican. The judge was born in Chicago. But a very smart legal commentator got to what really was going on here, that making these statements was calculated to intimidate the judge, and that was done by inciting anger and distrust among Trump's supporters. And when all this was happening, many in the media, for the first time that I can remember, actually took offense to this attempt to interfere with the judiciary. This all-out attack by a sitting president was viewed as shocking. It was an attempt to bully, or worse still, to intimidate the judiciary into getting the result that you want. And it was a not-so-subtle threat to incite the public, to have them believe that the judiciary and the justice system is disconnected to their concerns or from their concerns and responsible for making them unsafe. But you would be very wrong and naive to think that everyone reacted with shock and outrage. There are a number of the population, a substantial number, that believe that the judge acted inappropriately, that they are somehow less safe. So there are always people on both sides of an issue, but that's the thing about the judicial system, unlike politics. You don't just count up the most votes to decide an issue. You don't determine cases based on who is the loudest or the angriest or the more morally outraged. You decide based on facts, and your decision is always, always anchored in foundational democratic principles. Recognizing the precarious position that the country had placed in, one reporter commented that an independent judiciary was the last best hope at preventing Trump from violating the Constitution and illegally grabbing power. That was a prescient comment, because he hit on the one thing that I think was for quite some time being missed. The political power grab anywhere is tied to the delegitimization of the legal system, and the judiciary in particular. Look, judicial rulings are criticized all the time, and they should be. But there is a difference between criticizing a ruling and personally attacking the participants in the justice system. And even more important is who is doing the criticizing. Not all critics are the same. So if the president or the prime minister have a unique platform and authority, they then have a unique and particular responsibility not to undermine the very foundations of our democratic system. Now, decisions in criminal cases are the most susceptible to this sort of political distortion. Much of what judges do in other types of cases is of little concern to anyone but the litigants. But as one author stated, you can portray a judge's decision about bail or the exclusion of evidence or the imposition of a sentence, no matter how little discretion the judge actually had under the law, as putting the entire community at risk. A single decision in one of these cases can be used to distort the entire career of a judge. Now, this is not unprecedented at all. As one professor noted, the most common and effective attack on the judiciary is to suggest that a judge's decision indicates approval of criminal behavior, that they are soft on crime, or fail to impose the more severe sentence possible, which in turn is taken to mean that they are neither sympathetic nor empathetic to victims. But this has a long history. This is not new. For example, when a judge in New York suppressed cocaine and heroin seized in a big drug bust, the Republican candidate called for his impeachment. But listen to this, President Clinton indicated they would ask for his resignation if he didn't reverse his ruling immediately. And it was only after some criticism that Clinton issued a statement saying that the proper way for the executive branch to contest judicial decisions, which it disagrees with, is to challenge them in courts. It may be a message worth conveying to the public as well. Recently, in another case dealing with gerrymandering in the United States, in Pennsylvania, which involved the drawing of the congressional map, when the Republicans didn't like the result, they refused to accept the decision. But more importantly, they circulated a proposal to deal with this judicial activism. You've heard that phrase kicked around. By calling for the impeachment of 5 of the 7 justices. The Brennan Center for Justice reviewed judicial selection in state courts, and they concluded that millions of dollars go into negative ads in the United States where judges are elected that characterized candidates, judicial candidates, as issuing lenient sentences and failing to protect women and children. But the fascinating thing is when you peel it back and look at who it is that's running these soft-on-crime ads, they are organizations, big corporations that have nothing to do with criminal justice concerns. For example, one of the nastiest ads was run in 2014 that alleged that a sitting judge was a person who, quote, sides with child molesters because of his decision about a monitoring bracelet involving an accused. Do you want to know who ran the ad? Two massive tobacco companies who were frequent litigants in that court and were concerned that he would be sitting on their case. The same sort of thing happened in West Virginia, where a mining company ran a "For the Sake of the Kids" ad against a judge, a mining company that had no interest in criminal justice at all. In other states, it is well known that the way to defeat a judge is to run ads that are racially driven, showing a black accused because it resonates and frightens. In that case, the ad alleged that the judge had used loopholes to let a child rapist go free. And in fact, the judge was just a public defender at the time who had represented an accused person. Now, as you sit and hear me talking about this, you're saying to yourself, oh, well, that's just the United States. Those sorts of things don't happen here in Canada. But do not think for a moment that we are immune and safe in our Canadian politeness. We don't have a wall between the United States and Canada. Not yet, anyway. But we shouldn't take comfort in the theory that bad things only happen in other countries. Not even close. Because the creep has already started here. There are people in this country, politicians, that are playing by the very same playbook and winning. Judges now are routinely attacked by politicians, and the attack is what? You're out of touch with the public sentiment, or you're soft on crime. Think back to Premier Ford's recent outrage, some might call it a temper tantrum, when his attempt to redefine the city election was blocked by a judge. I'm elected, the judge isn't, he roared, decrying activist judges and completely failing to understand the importance of the separation of powers and an independent judiciary. What was the thrust of that argument? Politicians are more legitimate. The judiciary is not. But here is the scary thing. What happened when Premier Ford took that on? His comments were welcomed by politicians across the country in Canada who jumped on the bandwagon, decrying activist judges who dared to interfere with the will of the elected people. Look, as I look to the American political environment, I've thought to myself, maybe it's a blip. But the last 2 years have shown me that it is not, and I've not been able to turn away. I keep looking, sort of voyeuristically, at this car wreck to the south of us that is coming, careening towards us, and I come to a disheartening conclusion. It is not a blip. This democratic experiment is taking a beating not just in the United States, but in the world, as the populist tidal wave threatens to drown everyone. And with this thumping of this democratic experiment, our foundational democratic institutions are being shaken up. And chief on that block, chief, is the justice system. It is an easy first victim. Now, I often hear politicians, whenever they're confronted with an injustice, stake ground in the rule of law. But the rule of law is actually a very ambiguous concept. To some, when they say, I believe in the rule of law, it means law and order. While to others, it means individual rights and the protection of the minority. Whatever your leaning, your political leaning, the truth is, it is a fragile concept. And those that so willingly stake ground in it rarely are its greatest defenders. Do not let them fool you. As one person put it, there is no doubt that as a global community, we are painfully aware that the rule of law had some bad years of late, indeed a bad century. In the concentration camps of Nazi Germany, the gulags of Soviet Russia, the killing fields of Cambodia, and the genocidal wasteland of Kosovo, the rule of law was nowhere to be found, though perhaps with enough searching, one could uncover its remains. It has a way, after all, of being tyranny's first victim. There is a fundamental problem with the dialogue as it relates to the justice system. Effective democratic dialogue requires mutual attention and sufficient information to get to a reasoned decision. And the question that is posed well by one academic is, what do we do when we don't have sufficient knowledge on a given topic, but are still forced to make decisions about it? Because time and time again, that is what the public is asked to do when it comes to criminal justice reform, to make decisions without knowing facts. Worse still, politicians who are in charge of making these same decisions do the same thing. Long gone are the days of evidence-based criminal justice reform. Now, changes happen as quickly as a tweet. In fact, they are often responding to a tweet. The current discussion around criminal justice reform is premised on the false belief that all sorts of complex social problems will be solved at the courthouse door. By the time we are at the courthouse door, however, the bad thing has already happened. We as a society have failed. We have to acknowledge that. And the justice system is designed to do only one thing: to determine whether the person the state has chosen to prosecute is guilty or not. Every aspect of the criminal justice system is designed to answer that one question. And it's not a simple one. It's case-specific, fact-specific, person-specific. But the one thing the criminal justice system is not is a mechanism to cure social problems. There isn't a single tool in the entire arsenal of tools in criminal justice that is designed or equips it to do that. Other than the concept of general deterrence, the theory that through punishment, other like-minded criminals will be deterred, there's really nothing else. And we all know that this whole theory of general deterrence is largely disproven. Tough on crime policies or increased incarceration do not make us safer. The epidemic of mass incarceration, the disproportionate representation of African Americans in the United States and Indigenous people in Canada should cause any right-thinking person to wonder, how can that be? And the answer is clear, because enforcement is directed at those communities, because of inadequate representation, because once those individuals enter the justice system, they never leave it whole. They are marked with a scarlet letter for the rest of their lives, and everything from their work to their travel is impacted. And so in this discourse, the public often loses sight of the one and only thing that the justice system should be designed to achieve. Not reparation, not vindication, not closure. It has one singular focus, one thing and one thing only, to determine guilt or innocence. And every single rule, every foundational principle is focused on this one task, nothing more and nothing less. And I think that when we as a society begin to lose sight of the purpose of the system and its very limited function, we are misled. The grading system of our justice system isn't how good you feel coming out on the other side, because if it is, then surely it will always receive an F. It is rigorous and difficult, and as unpleasant as any medicine you ever had to swallow. It cannot be anything else. The success of our legal system, of our justice system, and the strength of our democracy, because the two are inextricably linked, is measured by its singular dedication, its discipline in making principled decisions unmoved by the clamoring at the courthouse door. But politicians peddle this lie and do so by manipulating public fear. The current successes of the rise of populism turn on a careful manipulation of fear, appealing to those who see their power eroding. It offers an easy answer to those who are feeling threatened or being treated unfairly or feeling as if they haven't gotten their due to find a common enemy and declare a war. That's how the language of fear finds its way into that democratic conversation. So you have politicians of all political stripes trading on this idea of fear in criminal justice. Fear of being unsafe, fear of a drug epidemic, fear of terrorists, fear of immigrants. Fear is an easy button to push, particularly when there's no counter-narrative being offered. How many times have you heard politicians claim that there is a crime wave, that the streets are virtually apocalyptic, that we are lawless, when the objective facts would demonstrate, the statistics would show, the crime had been on the decline? But facts rarely get in the way of fear-mongering. And when the panic has built up to such a feverish pitch, it becomes very hard to counter it. Telling someone who's having a panic attack that they're being silly and just need to calm down doesn't work. We need to figure out a different way to quell the collective panic that is driving us as a society in the wrong direction. The criminal law has become the first go-to move for politicians to solve complex social problems. Do you know why? Because it is a cheap and quick public statement that can be made with huge political upside and little downside. What politician, no matter what side of the political spectrum they sit on, is going to argue for the rights of an accused person? There's simply no political capital in this. There is, however, huge political capital on get tough on crime agendas. And when you combine that with the populist wave, that is an extremely powerful narrative. And it is a narrative you have to be aware that both sides of the political spectrum cling to. Think of this. In the United States, it was Bill Clinton who was responsible for the largest crime control bill passed, the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994. It was actually the largest crime bill in U.S. history. And it included increasing prisons, expanding the federal death penalty to cover about 60 offenses, creating the now notorious three strikes rule, which imposed mandatory life imprisonment without possibility for parole for federal offenders who'd been convicted of three convictions. It increased the maximum term of imprisonment for repeat sex offenders. It created new crimes and it increased penalties for drug trafficking and drug offenses. That was the Democratic legacy on criminal law. How else could you convince the public that you are not a bleeding heart liberal? Sacrifice the poor, the marginalized, the racialized, the rejected in society, the unpopular, the ones whose vote you don't need and you don't care about. That's why, in this one area, criminal law, in politics where they cannot agree on anything, it is so easy to get widespread agreement no matter what your political stripes. Here in Canada, we've not fared better. As of 2005, 29 offenses in the criminal code carried a mandatory minimum sentence of imprisonment. But under the Harper government, the total expanded to include 80, and 26 under the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act. And all of that was done with no resistance from any party. Why? Who would take up the cause against mandatory minimums and risk being called a protector of criminals or drug dealers or murderers? No one dared. And they still haven't. Think a few months ago in the summer when Premier Ford grandly announced that in response to the summer of the gun, we are, quote, sending a clear message to thugs that we're coming for them with legal SWAT teams. They used to be called prosecutors, but he calls them SWAT teams, who are instructed to oppose bail in gun offenses, to oppose bail for people who are presumed innocent and yet to be convicted. And yet the very weekend of this profound and moving announcement, three people were shot. The thugs weren't following Premier Ford's pronouncements quite as closely as he had hoped. But the message really wasn't for them, was it? The message was meant for potential voters. A get-tough-on-crime policy is an easy place for a politician to dip in for a few extra votes, no matter what their political stripes. But it does not make us any safer. That is a fact. More incarceration and stiffer penalties do not do anything to decrease crime or make our streets safer. The fake news that politicians, not the media, like to peddle is that we are better off with tough-on-crime policies. But years and years of research and studying done by experts who actually bother to spend time looking at this and looking at what works and what doesn't work tell us this is not so. So shouldn't we try something different, something that might actually work? Look, I've tried to remain upbeat, honestly, but I give up. I was just recovering from years of the Conservative government, and don't worry, I will hit every political government here. I'm not a friend of any of them, I gather. I was just recovering from years of the Conservative government criminal code changes. Remember the acts that had fabulously dramatic names like Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act, Faster Removal of Foreign Criminals Act, Life Means Life Act. That was pithy. Preventing Human Smugglers from Abusing Canada's Immigration System Act. Respecting Families of Murdered and Brutalized Victims Act. This one is my favorite. Serious Time for the Most Serious Crime Act. It was as though Dr. Seuss was writing our legislation. And I kept waiting for the You're Bad, So Sad Act or the One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish Act. But it wasn't all that funny. And so I admit that I breathed such a huge sigh of relief when a new shiny government was sworn in as I looked forward to sunnier days. Finally, a shiny, new, and promising breath of fresh air. No more policies being passed as though our Canadian streets were under constant violent siege. No, this was going to be an above-the-board, straightforward, pragmatic government that would be a modern antidote to our neighbors to the south. Evidence-based criminal law policymaking was just around the bend. But then, just as suddenly as it had happened, I fell out of love. True change seemed to be replaced with an overwhelming need to be liked and likable. And criminal policy seemed to be more responsive to tweets than social reality. It seems the goal was to say whatever would get you the most Facebook likes. Leading, even taking positions that are unpopular or require explanation, doesn't seem to be in the cards. And so, although court after court after court have criticized the wave of mandatory minimum sentences and their disproportionate impact on racialized communities, all policies put in by the previous government, this government has done nothing about it. In Canada, from 2006 to 2015, the amendments to the criminal justice system included creating numerous new offenses, reduced compassion in sentencing, reduced eligibility for conditional sentences, increasing maximum sentences, adding mandatory minimum sentences, limiting time for pretrial custody. Post-conviction pardon ineligibility periods were extended, and accelerated parole review was eliminated. Since 2015, those amendments remain largely unassailed. Other than the new cannabis legislation, the crime control model continues full steam ahead. Amendments to the code have been focused on victims' rights while ignoring any issues that would remediate the issues that were identified. Or the amendments have done away with procedural protections for the accused, such as the preliminary inquiry, in the name of efficiency. So where are we? Back to get tough on crime agendas. Why return to that old playbook? Because it works. It's a good sell. And since time immemorial, it's a good way to pick up votes. That's why, as I said, most crime bills generally have bipartisan support in the States and in Canada. And some of the worst crime legislation has been passed by those who claim to be progressive and liberal. So we continue to get crime-driven legislation in the absence of any evidence, just directed at a different area or under a different guise, sensitivity to women, sensitivity to minorities. But don't you get fooled by them. Same game, different name. There is no political capital in doing the hard work. In the United States, felons don't vote. In Canada, the marginalized aren't a vote that either party cares about. So when the options are tough, why spend your political capital on something that will reap little reward and bring with it a whole lot of heartache? Now, we cannot disentangle this problem from the environment that politicians operate in now. Long gone are the days where there was a pause between something happening in a courtroom and the report. In the olden days, when the public was interested, they actually had to do one of two things. Either physically bring themselves to a courtroom, or wait until experienced reporters provided the information. But information nowadays is uncurated on social media, and so are opinions. And this invariably presents politicians with a distorted view of the temperature of the public in a few ways. Firstly, the opinions and those that I gather get the most steam are not necessarily the most informed. And it's awfully difficult to engage in a meaningful exchange of information and ideas to come to a reasoned opinion in the context of a digital shouting match. Secondly, the loudest and most often tweeted does not necessarily represent the view of many people. There are many demographics that do not choose to express themselves through social media, but they vote. And finally, and most importantly, politicians forget that we are not stupid, that our minds can be changed, that we, as members of the public, can be engaged in reasoned discussion and debate that extends beyond 140 characters. Politicians should really give us a little more credit. The voting public deserve a little more credit than that. But instead, we've replaced Descartes' maxim, I think, therefore I am, with I tweet, therefore I am. Politicians communicate through Twitter. The American president has mastered it, probably the only thing he's mastered. And make no mistake, politicians react very quickly to the swell of Twitter. For example, recall the Stanley murder case out west, where the accused had been acquitted of shooting a young indigenous man, Mr. Bushi. Reacting to the tragic murder of Mr. Bushi out west, legislation to remove peremptory challenges on a jury was passed, faster than you can type out 140 characters. But the replacement of peremptory challenges, that is, when you can force a juror not to sit on a jury, does nothing, not a single thing, to relieve the indigenous community's lifelong treatment of inequality in the criminal justice system, or the decades-long social inequality that frustrates the indigenous community's ability to meaningfully participate in a justice system which has zero cultural resonance for them. You know what does? Eliminating mandatory minimum sentences. Removing jury challenges, this procedural tinkering, is not meaningful criminal justice reform. Speak to a single person that has experience with the criminal justice system, whether it be a Crown prosecutor, a defense lawyer, or a judge, and they will tell you that the over-incarceration of the indigenous community is the real epidemic, not jury challenges. The new report from Statistics Canada details the crisis. Pick a statistic, anyone. Over half the youth admissions are indigenous youth, notwithstanding they only form 7% of the population. Or how about the fact that in Saskatchewan, where the Bushi-Stanley trial occurred, 76% of admissions to jail were Indigenous people in 2016 and 2017. Yet the criminal justice reforms that would address these real issues, that would demonstrate a measure of reasoned compassion, gather no steam. So how then can criminal justice reform get momentum in our current political environment? If we are looking to curry favor with left or right leanings, we will continue to fail and be disheartened. But there is a bit of a lesson to be learned, again, from our neighbors to the south. Think of this, that President Obama, who was a significant supporter of criminal justice reform, did not expend his political capital on this issue until the second half of his second term. And his first major speech discussing publicly criminal justice reform happened only when he had 2 years left to go in office. His reforms were modest at best and dealt largely with presidential clemency. And it took 15 years to begin to unwind the devastation that the Clinton bill wrought. And what happened? The most extraordinary thing. It was like Christmas. The epidemic of mass incarceration was wound back just a little bit with the First Step Act. And guess who signed on to it? President Donald Trump, the same guy who wanted the Central Park Five boys who were ultimately found not guilty of a brutal crime in New York, he called for their death penalty, notwithstanding their exoneration. He signed the First Step Act. Why? Well, there's a lesson there. That act came into being because of groups and organizers that continue to shed light on the problem of mass incarceration and its racialized impact, and groups that discussed its economic failure to over-incarcerate. Every angle of the problem was brought to the fore, but that wasn't enough. In the end, the bill advanced through bipartisan support. Not only Democrats, but powerful conservative Republicans such as Ted Cruz and the Koch brothers and evangelicals and Christians who were believers in prison reform joined together. That's how that bill eventually began to have some air in its lungs. So when does criminal justice reform actually get momentum? Well, I think this blip tells us a few things. One, there is little public appetite for criminal justice reform unless the narratives are changed and challenged. This is the work of the people on the ground. Secondly, and most importantly, we must begin making the case for criminal justice reform by discussing all of it. It's the costs of incarceration, the purpose of our justice system, and the protection of democratic values. And all of this must be directed at getting support from political parties. We need to call out politicians that are trying to sell their snake oil to the public when they try to claim that they are all for making us safer and then point to immigrants as being the problem. We have to respond and say it's about resources and social safety. We can say those things because we know what the criminal justice can and cannot deliver. We can say that if you are really a feminist and want to improve the lives of women and make them safer, then provide education and financial independence and nationalized daycare, and you watch how quickly the statistics of violence against women change for the better. If you want to improve the lives of the indigenous community, don't change peremptory challenges. Provide the financial support, the independent courts, and the decreased incarceration of this community. We can resist the constant encroachment on our civil liberties, our individual rights, and uphold the protection of the minority. We can and we must reject these false political narratives. And recognizing that, we have to know that to build compassion in criminal justice reform, we must begin by building consensus. Thank you.